The United States Navy SEALs, considered by many to be the most elite group of soldiers on Earth, has a quote that they brand on the bottom of all their maps and their stationery. It's a quote that entirely encapsulates who they are. The quote is, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing." I believe the following quote is equally true. The only thing necessary for the triumph of mediocrity is humanity's obsession with normalcy. You see, the difference between a soldier who remains on the bottom rung and one who becomes a Navy SEAL is often not the physical strength or size of that particular soldier, but the ability for the soldier to dream and remain determined to rise in the ranks. He doesn't allow setbacks or challenges or failures to dull the fire of his dreams burning inside of him. What separates people who achieve greatness in their lives and those that don't is typically the strength of their desire to achieve. More often than not, success is not achieved by those blessed with unusual talents or abilities, but by regular people who really, really, really want it and refuse to let the status quo and complacency of the rest of the world prevent them from getting it. The same is very much true with spiritual greatness. This week's parsha contains the blessings and the curses given to the Jewish people on the mountains of Gerizim and Evil. Half of the Jewish people ascended Har Gerizim and the other half ascended Har Evil. And one group hears the curses that would be meted out for the wayward behavior our nation might one day exude, while the other heard the blessings that befall us if we act in accordance with Hashem's will. Now, there's something geographically odd about these two mountains. The two mountains, Har Gerizim and Har Evil, were mere feet away from each other, and yet Har Gerizim, the mountain of blessing, was lush and beautiful, filled with flowers and vegetation, while Har Evil, the mountain of curses, was barren, a desert, desolate. How did that come to be? These two mountains, which you can still visit today, are less than 200 feet from one another. They share the exact same ecosystem. They receive the exact same amount of rain. They have the exact same amount of sunlight. They are exposed to the exact same air quality. Why is one lush and vibrant while the other is hard and dead? So Reb Shlomo Rafael Hirsch explains that the only difference between these two mountains is that one was resistant and one was receptive. Har Gerizim had small little holes in it, allowing the nutrients and the rain and the sunlight to penetrate, while Har Evil was closed off and impenetrable. So although both mountains were exposed to the same amount, the same climate, only Har Gerizim allowed that climate to seep inside of it. So Reb Hirsch goes on to say that it was not for naught that Hashem chose to issue the blessings and curses on those two mountains specifically, for by doing so, he was telling us the recipe for spiritual greatness, which is forever opening ourselves up to be the spiritual, to collect the spiritual bounty that permeates all around us. All of us had dreams once upon a time of being spiritually great. Whether it was in third grade when we learned the story for the first time of Rachel Imenu, or when we heard the story of Yosef HaTzadik, or when we went off to yeshiva and we were hugely inspired in seminary. Perhaps it was a speech we heard on Tisha B'Av, or when we experienced our first real Rosh Hashanah. All of us had those flashing moments in our souls when we told ourselves, we will be great. So what happened? What went wrong? Why are most of us regular? The answer is that most of us don't allow the spiritual nutrients that are whizzing all around us to penetrate into our very essence. We stop aspiring for greatness and become more interested in fitting in. We tell ourselves that normalcy is better than standing out, even if normalcy comes at the expense of greatness. We become so shackled to the status quo that all our dreams and our hopes and our aspirations get replaced with an obsession to just fit in, to let the level of spirituality in our homes be dictated by the neighborhood around us. That's what we do. And the very moment one of our spiritual dreams goes up against what the current definition of normal is, we run right back to our safe little haven of normalcy. In no era could this motto be truer than ours. The only thing necessary for the triumph of mediocrity is humanity's obsession with normalcy. So by giving the brachos on Har Gerizim, a mountain that opened itself up to the nutrients around us, Hashem was telling us that the key to spiritual greatness is to allow the inspiration we all have access to, all around, penetrating all of us, to allow it to penetrate our souls, to let those spiritual nutrients blossom inside of us, to allow the spiritual ingredients floating in the air to help bring our dreams and aspirations to fruition, elevating us to greater spiritual heights, far higher than the peanut gallery below us. One day, 3,000 years ago, a Navi, a prophet, got up and gathered the Jewish people into the town square, and he made an announcement, and he declared, the next leader of the entire Jewish people will be named Shmuel, and he has yet to be born, but his birth is imminent. So this, unsurprisingly, led to a great excitement. A whole buzz erupted. Who would be the one to give birth to the next leader of the Jewish people? So with dreams of being parents of the future leader, everyone ran home and started naming their children Shmuel in the hopes that he would one day become the one, the leader of the Jewish people. So 40 years went by and not one of the boys named Shmuel was appointed leader. Not until Hannah came along, who after years of being barren, she finally gave birth to a son and named him Shmuel, and he was the one who eventually became the leader of the Jewish people. We all know the story. But the part of the story that lots of people don't know is what happened to all those other kids named Shmuel, all the hundreds of children whose parents with hopes and dreams named them Shmuel. What happened to them? So the Chidah, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai, says that despite not becoming the leader of the Jewish people, each and every one of those children nevertheless became a Navi. For each and every one of them grew up with a vivid dream, a dream that they might one day lead the Jewish people, a dream that they could be the most important man in the spiritual universe, a dream that they could reach the loftiest spiritual heights, and that dream carried them on its wings and allowed them to soar to the level of prophecy, a level of spirituality attained only by the most elite members of our nation. If we clutch close to our dreams and never let go, greatness can be achieved. But if we let ourselves do what most people do, because that's what most people do, our dreams of greatness slowly drift away. Here's another example. The difference between a Major League Baseball player who is making $33 million a year and has his name plastered on every newspaper in America and a Minor League Baseball player who makes $43,000 a year and has no one's ever heard of him is that the Major League Baseball player has a batting average of .280, while the minor leaguer has a batting average of .230, meaning that when the major leaguer stepped up to the plate, he hits the ball 2.8 times out of 10. The minor leaguer only hits the ball 2.3 times out of 10. Not a very big difference. Yet one is a famous millionaire and the other is a regular dude who shops at the same Walmart as you do. What led to the drastic difference? Both dreamed about becoming a baseball superstar. Both aspired for baseball greatness. The answer is that the major leaguer refused to let his dreams go. He woke up a little earlier. He stayed in the gym a little later. He ate a little healthier. He focused a little more. He was in the batting cages when the rest of his friends were eating ice cream. He studied films of his swing while his friends called him a fanatic. He read books and listened to tapes and left no stone unturned in his quest for baseball knowledge, despite being called crazy by his peers. He refused to let the temptation to be regular hold him back from achieving greatness, and sure enough, greatness he achieved. We should all be the same. We should aspire to live life with no lashon hara and never let go of that dream. To dream of a house buzzing with chesed and see to it that it happens. To dream of really being tznius and doing so despite the sneers and the social pressures. To dream of finishing shas and to never stop dreaming. To take the dreams we all had when we were young and close our eyes and accomplish them. There's a strange halacha in Shulchan Aruch, Arachayim Simin Kuf Pei Aleph Sivkatan Hey. It states that whenever one is about to say Birchas HaMazon, you got to first remove all the knives from the table. Only after knives are removed can one start benching. So what exactly is wrong with having knives on our table while we bench? Why do the spoons and the forks get to stay, but the knives got to go? So the Taz, Reb David Siegel, a Polish rabbi who lived from the years 1586 to 1667, he provides a very interesting reason for this strange halacha. He writes that there was once a man who dreamed and thought of the Beis HaMikdash to such an unbelievable extent that one day while he was benching, when he reached the part about Hashem rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, he got so distraught about its current state of destruction that he took a knife from the table and he stabbed himself. And thus, the custom to remove the knives from our table while we bench in order to prevent that from happening again. So let's ask an obvious question. This person was certainly a very, very holy man. But such an individual is an extreme outlier. Do halachic authorities really think that there's a practical need for this halacha? This guy was one in a million. Why institute this halacha for the entire Jewish people? So I heard a beautiful explanation from Reb David Revach, the Rav of Adas Torah in Los Angeles, California. He said that, of course, the rabbis were well aware of the unlikelihood that someone's actually going to grab a knife and stab themselves while benching. The rabbis never instituted it for that reason. They instituted the requirement to remove the knives as a reminder to us that there once upon a time was a man who dreamed so much about the Beis HaMikdash that when he read about its destruction, he was so distraught and he was so angry and he was so depressed that he stabbed himself to death. We are instilling in ourselves that there was a time when men dreamed about the Beis HaMikdash to such an extent that its absence caused so much pain and anguish they couldn't refrain from stabbing themselves. Not that we're on that level, but that we should at the very least know that that level exists and we should aspire to reach it. We cover our knives as a small reminder to keep on dreaming, to never let greatness get away from us. To never let the conveniences of normalcy and mediocrity take precedence over the glory of greatness. Every few years, the world becomes transfixed by the World Cup, an event that takes basically over the world. It takes the global stage by storm. Every country in the world trots out their best soccer team in the hopes of climbing to the top of the soccer world and claiming that trophy. Russia to China, Argentina, United States, France, Australia, the whole world shows up. But what fascinates me the most about the entire event are the smaller countries that manage to succeed. Countries like Costa Rica and Senegal and the Netherlands and Morocco and Croatia and Panama. Tiny little countries that often take down countries 500 times their size. And when you think about it, it almost makes no sense. America, with a pool of 400 million people from which to choose its soccer team, loses to the Netherlands, a country that has 17 million people. Countries with every technological advancement and with access to every form of medical and training equipment are losing to Senegal, a third world country in Africa that doesn't have running water. How do you explain this phenomenon? The answer is that America might like soccer. These countries live soccer. These countries breathe soccer. These countries go to sleep thinking about soccer and wake up thinking about soccer. Every thought that crosses their mind is soccer. Every dream they dream is soccer. Not only that, but they are children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of people who are obsessed with soccer. Soccer runs through their blood. It is infused into their very DNA, and therefore, despite being 1% of the size, despite having no medical technology, despite living in a third world dilapidated country, they often come out victorious because for them, soccer is everything. We are a nation obsessed with spiritual greatness. We are a nation obsessed with godliness. We think and speak and dream about Hashem. Godliness runs through our veins. It is part of our DNA. Our dreams won't be dashed by the people who say we can't. Our dreams won't be dashed by the people who say we are wrong. Our dreams won't be dashed by the people who call us archaic and outdated. The Jewish people clutch close to their dreams stronger and with more passion than any other dreamers out there. That's why we are still here dreaming while the nations of the world have taken their dreams and vanished long ago. We dream about spiritual greatness and no one will ever convince us not to. The difference between the people who achieve greatness and ones that don't has little to do with their talents and their upbringing and exposure and their environment. Many great people are brilliant and many more great people aren't. Many great people could sit and focus for hours and many other great people can't. Many great people are born leaders and thinkers and orators and many aren't. The common denominator among all great people is that no matter what and no matter when, they never stop dreaming. They take their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations and they never let go as long as they live. We are a nation of dreamers. We are a nation that got its blessings on Har Gerizim, the mountain forever open to the nutrients around it. Lucky are those people who never let go of their dreams. Lucky are those people who don't let mediocrity, normalcy, and the pressure to be regular rip those dreams of greatness from them. Lucky are the people who, despite being in a class of 36 and a grade of 400 and a school of 5,000, dream for even more and even higher. We are a nation of dreamers. Lucky are those who know how to keep on dreaming.